All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We got a packed show for you today, and it's really one of these over-the-top shows, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking to you in the beginning of the show. I'll just jump right into it. At the back end of the show, we'll be talking with playwright Wendy Graff and two of the actors from her new play, Closely Related Keys. A tremendous play, so stay tuned for that. You don't want to miss that. But opening the show up, a very, very special segment. I had a chance back in January during the Sundance Film Festival to spend some time talking with a really, really unique and important filmmaker in the world today, Hubert Saupert. And some of you may remember Hubert from his earlier film, Darwin's Nightmare. And he's got a new film out now called We Come as Friends. And I'm telling you, it's an amazing, very powerful, just very important film. So if you get a chance to see it soon, don't miss it, all right? And I'm sure you'll get a chance to see it. But in the meantime, I had an interview with Hubert that lasted about an hour and a half, and so we're going to run it in two parts. The first part is running today. The second part will run next week, and so make sure you come back for that. I'm sure after you hear the first part, you'll want to come back for the second. So let's jump into it right now. This is an interview I did with Hubert Saupert, filmmaker, with about his new film, We Come as Friends. And it's all about imperialism and colonialism in Africa, and especially in South Sudan. I'm very happy to welcome to the show the director of a film I saw here at Sundance that was just a remarkable film, very powerful, very emotional. I'm easily driven emotionally, but your film really just knocked me in my seat. I was just mesmerized by the whole thing. And his name is Hubert Saupert, and people might know him as the director of a film that was out a few years back called Darwin's Nightmare, and he's the director of this new film that I'm talking about, which is We Come as Friends. Hubert, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Nice having me. Thanks for having me.
Definitely, man. Well, why don't you give people, before we start, give people a synopsis of the film itself.
All right. That's a hard one. You know, I've been working for 6 years on this film called We Come as Friends, and if you want me to resume it into one or two lines, it's an attempt. I try to condense a very complicated issue into a movie. Of course, that's my work as a filmmaker, and that is to try to figure out what is the pathology of colonialism. It's hard to explain in a quick way. But there's something kind of encrypted in our veins almost, that we, let's say, the Western culture, we the Europeans, I'm a European, have been overthrowing civilizations, killing, you know, millions of people in the world. And as we did, like annihilates, you say, or mm-hmm. annihilates civilizations over the centuries in the Americas, in Africa, in Asia, we always had to come up with a narrative that kind of excuses us for doing this. And the narrative was, of course, supported by Christianity. We, the Europeans, we always had to come up with a way to explain to ourselves that we are actually really good people while we are killing everyone else on the other side of the world.
And that's a good job, man.
It's a complicated thing, but because it's kind of a part of our civilization, it is very refined. It's you know, I can, if you want to stretch the argument, you know, it's kind of a, it's a bit of a stretched metaphor, but I can say it, I think, on your radio station, is when you imagine an individual who's a murderer or is a pedophile, or what, let's say a pedophile, and he goes home and he spends a lot of money to sponsor an orphanage. He insists to all his friends how much he loves children, you know. So there's something so pathological in his behavior or her behavior. And I think in a collective way, our civilization suffers from the same schizophrenia, you know. Mm. And I think it's a fact, and it's something that we have to kind of come to terms with or fight against. But we can only fight against it if we are ready to see it as a problem, you know. I think it's a collective problem, you know. Mm-hmm. So the movie We Come as Friends is basically it's a very straightforward documentary film, which is set in the South Sudan, and in Sudan, at the very moment when the Sudan, the biggest country of Africa, was split into two pieces. And that was a very crucial moment in history, because the division of cultures and countries and nations was a crucial method, a crucial tool of colonialism. So the European colonialists came to Africa a bit over 100 years ago and cut it into 50 or something, 52 pieces, called nations now. And that is called division of it's called divide and rule, basically. Mm-hmm. The more you divide, let's say, intact kingdoms, the easier it is to rule those kingdoms, you know. And sometimes the borders which had been made in colonial times were also actually containing tribes into one nation which were already at war, which is also a problem. And then it's also easier to rule this new formed nation. So the Sudan was basically the last episode of a long, long tradition of division of Africa. And the interesting thing is, of course, that while it is happening, the narrative which we got in America or in Europe or even in China was that this country has to be split in two pieces because they are so different. The north is Arabic, the south is Christian. They don't get along. They should all have a separate country, and then everyone is going to be happy and it's going to be peaceful. Of course, it's not true that everyone was Christian in the south. It's also true that a lot of Christians were in the north. It's clear that the problem between the north and the south was not religious. It was basically a problem that was created by powerful people who wanted the division, you know, and who wanted the division to basically divide the wealth of the country. And mainly it was or is the oil in the Sudan. But at stake is also the water of the Nile. The Nile River flows straight from the south to the North Sudan and then on to Egypt. There is an unbelievable amount of gold and silver and uranium and you name it, and a lot of arable land. So, you know, it's a very stretched thing to say, but in some way the Sudan was split into two hemispheres, and I would say into a Chinese hemisphere and an American hemisphere. Hmm. So China and America basically cut this country into two, and you know, this is of course a simplified way to say it, but there's something to it. Mm-hmm. And what was not said during this division of the Sudan is what was not mentioned is that everyone was speaking about the new nation going to be born and people are going to be happy and they're all the same, but no one really talked about the fact that there's a new border created. Which is something 2,000 miles long, and typically in Africa, borders are not a very safe place to be. So if you happen to live near that new border, you're potentially in very bad shape, mm-hmm. and there's a good chance that your children are going to die from some kind of violent action.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with filmmaker Hubert Salpert about his new film, We Come As Friends.
Well, there's a couple of things there. I mean, I'll return to the thing about the pathology of colonialism a little bit later. But I wanted to, you know, part of this thing, even with the borders, I mean, as you're saying this, and you talked about created these two hemispheres, mm-hmm. the Chinese and the American. You know, it's really interesting because there is this point that throughout Africa, I mean, it is true that the borders of African nations, you know, they didn't match, a lot of times they didn't match in way, shape, or form. They didn't match anything to do with what a lot of the tribal areas were, and you have tribes split down the middle. They basically were lines that were drawn in the earth around whatever you can hold with a gun, whatever you can defend, the imperial powers, whatever you can defend, you can have. And so it's true, these borders were very artificial in the sense that, but then they also became battle lines,
right.
and continued to be like that. And one of the things I wanted to ask, you know, you've done a few other films, a couple of other films at least I know of in Africa, right? The Kisangani Diary and Absolutely. Darwin's Nightmare. And you can talk about that if you want. I mean, the question I was going to raise to you is, so this would be your third film on Africa.
Yeah.
And is there a development, is there a reason why you keep coming back to Africa, and is there a development and a progression to what you're doing with your films on Africa?
Yeah, one of the reasons why I'm interested in Africa is of course, because I'm a European, and Europe has a very, very, very connected history with Africa. It is completely connected. For example, exactly a century ago, the First World War started to the month, almost a century ago. And that war, the First World War, was basically a colonial war. The problem was that the German Empire at the time, and the British Empire, and the French Empire, and the Russian Empire were coming to a point after having developed very high-end industries. They came to a point that they kind of realized that they're going to need a lot of resources in the future, a lot of workforce, a lot of like slave workforce from abroad. And each empire was kind of imagining that going to be a shortcoming for someone, right? So, of course, the trigger of the First World War was the killing of Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo and so, but the mood that came up to it was a colonial dispute, basically, which is not really written in history books very much. And then, 20 or what years later, the Nazism was the consequence of it. So the colonial history and Europe is so interconnected. By the way, one of the scenes in my film, We Come As Friends, takes place in a place called Fashoda, which was basically the epicenter of the collision of the two big empires in the late 1800s, in 1898. Mm-hmm. That was Britain and France, when they clashed into each other, basically, in a small fishing village on the Nile. And that fishing village was on the crossroads between the two imperial axes. And basically, the British already had like colonized the north of Africa, the Nile, Egypt, and also the South Africa, together with the Dutch, the Boers. And they were obsessed by connecting those two points in Africa. So basically connecting the north to the south, the Nile to the Cape. And the French had a similar obsession. The French had colonized West Africa, most of all Senegal and surrounding countries. And they had military outposts in Djibouti, on the Indian Ocean. So the French were obsessed to connect these two points and make a big imperial unity from east to west. And obviously the two interests would cross somewhere, and they figured out they were basically drawing two lines across the continent. And the two lines were meeting precisely in the South Sudan, on the Nile, in a little place called Fashoda. So the two extremely, at the time, nationalistic nations or empires, extremely fascist, I would almost say, and extremely racist, they were driven by racism. Those two nations were racing for Fashoda, like 1968, the race for the moon between the Soviets and America, right? Same story. They were racing with a very big investment, with big armies across the continent of Africa, both armies. The French went up to Congo with a steamboat. They dismantled the steamboat, thousands of porters, of course, slave porters from local people were carrying the machines, of course, not the French. The French were even carried themselves by locals. And the British were racing up the Nile and the French were faster, and they took this little town called Fashoda. And the British came a few months later and were militarily superior, and they put up their flag also in Fashoda, and they came to a crazy crisis called the Fashoda Crisis in 1898, where both empires were at the brink of a world war, which is 1898, which is like 16 years before the actual world war. So Britain and France almost went to war in Europe over the crisis of Fashoda. And the crisis kind of ended with the fact that the French gave up. The French gave up the Sudan. And this is the reason why in Sudan people speak now French, not French, in English. This is why Kenya is English speaking and Tanzania. Basically, the whole of East Africa is now English speaking. Influence because of Fashoda. In exchange, actually, the British said, well, that is nice of you to leave us, to let East Africa to us, and we will give you to the French in exchange Morocco. So Morocco became, as a little cadeau, a little present, a French colony, to the detriment of the Germans, because the Germans also wanted Morocco, and it's just a crazy this whole story. So, and it ended up triggering the First World War.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with filmmaker Hubert Salpert about his new film, We Come As Friends.
So understanding this is what's driven you to make these films?
Well,
or is it just a story?
No, it's like, this is story. The thing is that history is extremely complicated, and history is basically not what happened, but what is being told, right? This is history. What is the narrative? And I think it's important not only what is being told, but how it's being told, you know? And documentary cinema is an amazingly effective tool to tell stories, because you don't only have information, you have, as an audience, the feeling to encounter people. If the film is made well, you kind of feel you're there. You are in front of these people. You get scared. You get intrigued. You're confused. I think as a documentary filmmaker, at least for me, I think it's very important to recreate passion that you live as a filmmaker. It's not that I go to Africa and then I come back. I'm going to tell you what the truth is or what the facts are, you know. The facts are being transported by CNN and the BBC. But still, you know, of course, a documentary film is factual, you know. People are real people. No one is an actor. People say what they really think is the truth. But a lot of things in documentary films have to be read in the second and third degree.
What do you mean?
If an officer of the UN shows you a plastic model of the future of the South Sudan, it looks like a little Disneyland or something, and he insists on and on and on how beautiful the future will be and how great it will be. And the more he insists, of course, the more you as a spectator in the cinema would sit back and say, wait a minute, what is he trying to tell me, right? But I'm not going to be over-voicing this as a filmmaker. I'm not going to say, look, he's a liar or something, or I just let people speak. And sometimes, you know, so to say, I give them enough rope so they can hang them themselves, you know, with their arguments, which I think, of course, I have clear opinions, of course, as a, in some way, also political activist, you know. But I think the efficiency of a documentary film like this is not what you see and hear, but what you feel and what you understand between the lines sometimes, you know.
I'm going to come back to that, actually, because that's something I did want to explore a little bit. But I have to ask you, too, before we get too far into it lose this. Your perspective from the film is shaped in a very unique way in a plane that I wouldn't sit in, even if it was on the ground, because I'm scared of it. Talk about how you made this film.
When you start a documentary film project, it's really a big chunk of life. And one of the biggest questions you ask yourself is, what am I doing? Why am I doing this, and how am I doing this, and how is my access to the places and the people I want to film? So the procedure, the normal procedure would be like you call people, you say, can I go film you? You apply, you call to, you know, authorities, you apply for visas, and you go through embassies. Let's say you want to shoot as a documentary filmmaker in a Chinese oil field in the middle of a war zone in Central Africa, you may as well take like 15 years to get a permission, right? And you may as well just never get it. So one way to find access is a certain form of anarchy. So we built actually a small flying machine, as you said, a flying lawnmower, basically, which is named Sputnik, because Sputnik is the Russian word for companion. Mm-hmm. And it's a tiny machine, but it's actually has a very powerful engine. It has very big wings, and big wings means that you can't fly very fast, but you won't die if you ditch it into a bush. So and you can land on a little strip of field or a football field or a country road or something, which we did. And then we went from France all the way down to the North Africa, along the Nile to the Sudan, and literally fell from the sky into military camps, into Chinese oil fields, into UN camps, and we were facing very amazing astonishment every time. Of course, people were saying, like, "Where the hell do you come from?" You know, and in some cases we really had to land because we needed fuel and food, and we need to sleep somewhere, and so. But sometimes we kind of use it as a Trojan horse, you know. It's like we fell from the sky and we said, look, we need your help. So we were taken in and we were treated nicely, and we connected to people very easily because this flying machine looks so ridiculously small and inoffensive that people took pity for us too, you know. So they said, like, you guys good that you're still alive. Come have dinner with us, you know. And then some guys wanted to go for a ride, so we took them for a ride just to connect. Some people wanted to see their house from above, and so we go for a little ride. And then in exchange, they would tell us about their lives. How this kind of filmmaking works is I was in this tiny airplane with my great friend Barney Broomfield, and we were literally and figuratively high, you know. This little airplane was our kind of LSD. We were in it, and we were so happy to be up, and we were so happy to having escaped from the military every time. And we experienced this extreme place and this extreme way of living. We were in extreme situations in a very passionate way. And we had a lot of fun, you know. We were laughing our asses off sometimes, you know, just the way, how ridiculous we were ourselves in pilot shirts, how crazy everything got, and how we just escaped in the last moment from another, you know, dangerous situation. And we were so passionate about the beauty of the people we met and how amazingly great their analyses are sometimes, you know. Sometimes very poor people would tell you something so smart and so strikingly beautiful. And we, Barney and I, we experienced that really as a team. It's like, did you just see what I saw? Or did you see how beautiful this old woman just looked at us or something, whatever, you know? And because we kind of shared this passion, we could also make these kinds of images passionately. And then it's in the images, if you want it or not. It's like a magical thing, you know. It's almost it's a magical thing. And then you as a viewer in the cinema, you get struck by that same lightning, you know, if things go right. We would also, of course, we did something which is not in the movie, actually. We were constantly filming and editing our own trip. And we had a little projector, and we projected the film that we had made so far on the white canvas of the plane. And so we kind of organized cinema evenings sometimes where people would see themselves with what we just shot that afternoon. And, you know, the kids would scream, you know. It would be amazing, amazing atmosphere. And
what a trip.
So we were almost like a wandering circus, you know, mm-hmm. and flying circus or something, you know. And that gave us a special position. People then, after a few days, knew we were the crazy guys with the little airplane, and they came along. And, you know, all these scenes actually we had shot, and I had planned to include it into the film. Our trip and our mishaps and our problems with the military, which were very, very often. Because, you know, the military, they don't necessarily like, you know, clowns with little airplane looking from the sky with cameras. It's a menace, you know, it's a threat.
Which brings up the point about the military uniforms you were wearing.
Yeah, I'll say this in a second. But what I was going to say is, like, all these things that we, let's say we the Westerners, bringing a nice little film to these people, I didn't want to include it in the film because I didn't want to be one of these good people that bring food and the good white person who does all these nice things and makes a change. And so actually, I'm a bit in the film, but more like a lost figure, you know, like a figure, like somebody who is kind of overwhelmed by what he sees, which was also a case, you know. So you see me in a few cases in the film, but not necessarily in a position of somebody who is superior or who brings biscuits for the children in Sudan, you know. But as you said, the uniforms. So in our flying tin can, we landed. I was held for a month in Libya, which was still then was still Gaddafi's. I was just held up because I just was this traveling guy, and I was wearing t-shirts and blue jeans. And later on, same thing happened in Egypt. I was treated like shit because they said we were. Permissions are not good enough, your plane doesn't have the right insurance for our country, whatever, there's always something, you know. And I had to go to the Ministry of Defense in Egypt, which is a very awkward place to be as a flying clown, you know. And so I was handed from one general to another, and they all wanted to check me out, and they thought I was Mossad or CIA, so I had to, like, insist that I'm not CIA, or, you know. And of course, they didn't believe me, so they didn't want to let me go. You know, so, and when they did let me go, I was like flying like a couple of hundred miles, and then got to the next airstrip, and then they said, "You're grounded again." Another week of delay. So it was really, really hard until I kind of understood that when you deal with these uniformed people, you kind of have to become one of them, you know. So we started wearing pilot's uniforms, and I had four stripes on my shoulders, and I became, I kind of muted into a captain on this flight, on this, and which is on its in itself a very colonial thing, you know, uniforms. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of muted into a colonial person. From then on, the journey was much easier. Mm-hmm. And then we came to an airstrip, and then I didn't talk to the little soldiers anymore. I just asked, "Where is the commander?" The commander came up and saluted us and was very happy to greet us. And it was very formal, and suddenly, and we, of course, we were laughing. We were just, it's just so ridiculous, you know. If you'd see the, I mean, if this is radio, you can't see the little Sputnik, but it's just outrageous, you know.
It is an incredible flying machine.
Yeah.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with filmmaker Hubert Salpair about his new film, We Come As Friends.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. Yeah. I read somewhere where, at least in the early stages of entering into this film, you had recommended to some people that they read King Leopold's Ghost to get sort of set them in the sense of what you were trying to do.
Right.
Talk about that a little.
Well, King Leopold's Ghost is one of the most beautiful books about the devastation of colonialism. It was written by a friend of mine, Adam Hochschild, who's an amazing scholar. Well, in the title, it's already kind of emerges that it's not about the King Leopold, which was the Belgian king who owned the Congo, which was like 20 times bigger than Belgium, or 100 times bigger or something, you know. He owned it, he had never been there. And why the title is so good, that it's King Leopold's Ghost, is because this is exactly what I said before. It's a pathology of wanting to dominate something you don't even know on the other side of the world, and to submit and subdue and slowly assimilate and militarize and exploit and kill. King Leopold killed indirectly 10 million people. 10 million people. Which was by then, I think what Adam Hochschild said, was about half of the population of the Congo. And it happened in the dark, because not many people had, you know, video cameras at the time. Nobody had little airplanes to look from the sky. Nobody had access to these places. It's a very, very, very sinister history. And the scary part of it is that this history is not over. It is not over. One thing is, you shouldn't forget this, when the Europeans colonized basically the whole planet, right, with arms and with guns and germs and diseases, they would carry the smallpox and the flu into the Americas, and India would die from I don't know what. So the disease always worked in favor of the colonizers, except in the center of Africa. The center of Africa, which means basically the south of the Sudan and the east of the Congo, is the very, very core of Africa. In that place, the diseases worked in favor of the locals, because the colonizers, the Boers, the white, would come and they would die from malaria. The locals wouldn't. The cows of the British settlers would die from tsetse fly or I don't know what, and the cows of the locals would not die. So the reason why the east of the Congo and the south of Sudan was not colonized has no other reason, I think, than diseases. It was just too wild for Europeans to get there. And now, in 2011, you know, with the big jumbo jets, with billions of dollars, and with air-conditioned cabins of the UN camp, and with very high-end medical equipment, we can do it. It seems almost like the whole planet decides to crack down on the last people who are kind of still free from our way of living. And it's almost like we're obsessed by something under our skin. We're obsessed by something that we have to kill off the last witnesses of human beings who remind us what we were once, maybe, or so. I don't know what it is. You know, there's something really, really, really perverse in it, you know.
You know, you talk about this pathology of colonialism, which you're just referring to again. You know, how do you see that in relation to the existence of a worldwide imperialist system that enforces economic and social relations that are geared towards doing anything at all to get profit. And that's the key motive. And I've, you know, look, I traveled through a lot through different parts of Africa over the last couple of decades. And, you know, you could see, and you know that, you see the things when you look at this. Yes, there's, you know, you could step back and say, sort of the first impression, it's a pathology. But that pathology is rooted in something bigger. And that's what always got me is, you know, understanding that there was something much bigger that was, you know, determining, for instance, why Namibia, there was an extinction of the Herero people. There was a genocide against the Herero people.
The Germans, yeah.
And it was all driven by this need for profit and this, because if they don't do it, somebody else is going to come in and get it.
It's a very difficult question. You know, why did the Germans go after these people in Namibia? Why? I mean, was it only profit or was it some kind of collective brain damage or something, you know, that the Germans said, well, those guys are the others. They called them the Negroes by then. In German, the Neger. And they had to be hunted down. But it's psychosis. It's not only, I think, a drive for profit or for... It's a subconscious madness, I think, also. But not only, of course, but also. Mm-hmm. And... I don't know the story of Namibia well, but I mean, maybe these tribes were in a place where the Germans would have found gold or something. I don't know precisely where.
Right. You could look at Kenya.
Right.
Know, I mean, I remember a friend who was born in Kenya and eventually had to leave. They used to tell me about the British having skeet shooting contests.
Right.
You know, skeet shooting where
shoot people. Yeah.
But they would shoot people. Yeah. And the aristocrats, the landed gentry, would stand around and they would whip the Africans to force them to run into the field, and then they would
shoot them
like they were skeet.
Yeah.
You know, and so, and when you think about that, it wasn't just this like sickness they had, but there was a whole view, you know, all the social relations, the whole view that they have of African people is rooted in, and it impacts this point about profit, but it's also rooted in there because they enslave people, they dehumanize them, and then anything they do to them, they're working them to death, starving them for, you know, just work them until they drop dead and bring in 1,000 more, you know, and it's rooted in something much bigger, I think, than just a screwed up brain. You know?
Yeah, it's really hard to tell. It's really hard to tell. What I do know is that now, let's say 100 years on to that story you're just referring to, of course, nobody on the planet really would say I want to shoot people in Africa. Nobody. Most people would say we should help them, save them, support them. But the scary thing is that as we say that we want to support them, we also destroy them. That is the scary part. Because what I saw very clearly in the East Congo and in the South of Sudan is that a lot of people were very, very capable of feeding themselves very easily, and they have gardens, they have cows, they have food, until somebody comes along and says, like, all the young guys who are strong, come with me, get a gun, we're going to go after the other tribe because they want to claim the contracts for oil. And the guys who are fighting, they don't even know what oil is, you know, at that point, you know. They don't even know how to shoot, they don't know how to wear a uniform, they just want to have life, you know, they just want to live, you know. But the guys who come, let's say the warlords, they know how to wear uniforms because they were growing up in missionary schools, you know. And they developed over generations a very deep-rooted disgrace for people who are not yet close to Jesus or close to Allah or whatever, you know. I'm saying this because the Muslim colonialism is just the same, you know. If you see it from the perspective of a Central African village, if foreigners come with the Bible or the Quran, it's like absolutely no difference for them. It's like they're foreigners, they speak a language you don't understand, they wear clothes, they tell you what to do, they tell you you have to march in step, they tell you you have to sit quietly, you have to listen when somebody prays. All the spirits and all these beautiful things that you until now thought was kind of religion is no longer valid. Now we have a different kind of God. It's one God and so on and so forth. Only that is so violent. What I'm saying is that this African elite, which is either indoctrinated by Mohammed or by Christ, whatever, want to do everything they can to assimilate the not yet assimilated people to God or Jesus or Mohammed. So it's a very scary thing, you know.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with filmmaker Hubert Salpert about his new film, We Come as Friends. And this is a film that's about colonialism and imperialism in Africa, and in particular in South Sudan. And that was part one of my interview, and we'll have a part two next week. So make sure you come back for that. You don't want to miss it. It's a killer, killer movie and a killer interview. So tune in again next week to get the rest of it, all right? We're going to take a quick break now and be right back to talk about Wendy Graf's new play, Closely Related Keys. So stay tuned. Welcome back. I'm Michael Slate, and that was Congo Part 1 from The Twisting Kings. I'm really pleased to welcome to the show three people who recently gave me, once again, a really intense experience, and it was a play called Closely Related Keys. And I'm sitting here now with the playwright Wendy Graf, who has written plays that I have just been driven crazy by. I really like. We were just talking about a little before the show, talking about Behind the Gates, also Bitter Lemons. There's about 1,000 plays she's written. And Wendy, welcome to the show.
So glad to be back.
Sure. And you're back talking about your new play, Closely Related Keys. And joining us in the studio as well are two of the actors from Closely Related Keys. Sitting right in front of me is Yvonne Huff. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Sure. Glad to be here.
And there's two key characters in the play, and you're one.
Yeah.
And sitting to the left of me is Diarra Kilpatrick. Diarra, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. And you play one of the other lead characters in Closely Related Keys. So all of you, welcome again.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
Thanks
for having me.
Let's jump into this. Wendy, give people a sense of what the play is about.
Well, it's about two sisters. Well, it's about a family. But the kickoff of the play is two sisters, one from Iraq and one from America, who find out that they're sisters, and they never knew they were before. They never knew they had a sister. What happens? It's like dropping a pebble into a water and all the concentric circles, all the implications of this restructuring of the family and the definition of what family is and the clash of cultures. And the journey of the play is really them finding out. At the top of the play, they think, and the audience thinks, they couldn't be more different. They're from two different worlds. They couldn't be more different. But the journey of the play is to find out that they're a lot more alike than different. They're closely related keys, which means two keys sharing many common tones, because there's a musical component to the play as well.
On every level, the music really got me. And especially, we'll talk about it a little bit later. The Motown sequence, it's right here, okay? Right there in my heart. I just can't get over it. Well, let's talk about what you guys thought about it. Diarra, what was your sense when you first looked at this play?
Well, I was struck by, at the beginning of the play, you get to see Julia, my character, is a little bigoted towards Vaughn's character. Just a tad. And I think that's something that you hardly ever see. Is black characters or characters that are in the minority, quote unquote, who are just sort of shamelessly bigoted, really, and adopting what we sort of have come to think of as white patriarchal sort of sensibilities about people from other places. So that was really interesting to me. What stood out to me was that it was a sort of different tale. And then this character was on paper almost like a wasp, but she was a black woman. And even though she was so successful in her career and had been to Yale and been through private school, she was still feeling the brunt of racism in her work and in her job. And so I thought all those things were really interesting themes that I wanted to explore and hadn't got a chance to do anything even remotely close to that before.
Mm-hmm. Now, Yvonne, you came into the play at really just about the last minute.
0 hour.
Yes. Well, I was familiar with the play before I actually took over
the role of Nayla Dirbash. My theater company, Lower Depth Theater Ensemble, we did a workshop of it about a year ago.
Exactly, a year ago.
Yeah. And so I was definitely familiar with the world of the play. I kind of know the entire play. So it was interesting to kind of change my whole mindset and kind of embrace my own otherness in, you know, being in the States, because I am also biracial, the same way the character is biracial. So I had to kind of look at all of that in a way that I hadn't looked at in a very long time. Mm. So that was something interesting to explore. And to tell you the truth, jumping in, like you asked her, what were you interested in about the play? And I just dove in like a
We just said,
surfer.
Be there. Here's the walk here. Know your line. Yeah. She's amazing. She's incredible. Yeah.
But I was definitely struck by the family aspect of the play. I would have to say that part about sisters coming together and how you see this family try to accept the family that they actually have, and how do you get there? And so I love that part of it.
Wendy, tell me this, because you also have, your director is Shirley Jo Finney,
mm-hmm.
and a remarkable director. And actually it has something to do with what Diarra was saying too, because she's directed a lot of plays that dig into the African-American experience. And in this play, this point that you were making about, this is not what you would typically see. It's a play that has at its heart black characters. But what's being dealt with, and telling you, everybody's sitting there waiting because you're thinking, okay, this is somehow going to play out in relation to black people in this country and what they're going through. And then you're watching it and you're realizing the depth and complexity of these characters. In a way, I don't want to say it transcends, because it doesn't transcend, but it actually, you really get an experience that's very different. You portray an experience that's very different because you have, as you said, Diarra, not just people dealing with prejudice and bullheadedness and just being plain downright nasty sometimes. Not you.
Right.
But it's true, because, and yet you're very sympathetic in a certain sense, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the same with you, Yvonne. You have your own things where your character is also can be pretty nasty at times, you know, interestingly enough, even though more, I mean, that time, well, we'll get into it in a minute, but there was a time where you just had an outburst that was, I think, shocked the entire audience. Suddenly you went from being quiet and sort of okay and not melting, but you sort of went into, I hate America, I hate what you did, I hate what he did.
Well, I think it shocked her. I think that was part of the through line that shocked that character. It shocks Nayla as well.
But, you know, but it's interesting because it has a lot to do with, when you were talking about the family aspect and stuff, but it has a lot to do with more than that is happening here, because people are being, they're being deconstructed, how they view the world is being deconstructed, and then they're building new things. And there's a whole way and that doesn't happen easy, you know? And I thought this was really interesting, because to put a mainly black cast, and especially the two principal characters as black characters, yet they're dealing with something that is so much more universal and so much bigger.
But Nayla doesn't really speak in terms of, you know, in America where things are polarized by black culture, white culture. She speaks about it in a global sense of who's American and who's not.
Yeah, and I think that Julia is a very American character.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of times black people or Asian people don't get to play those kinds of very American characters who are just victims of growing up here, you know? And it's like, as a black woman, for me, I thought, oh, I'm so black and I'm so militant. And then I went to Thailand to live for 4 months and I was like, where is the mall? You know what I mean? It's like, we're so American. And so it's true that it does get into universal themes, but I think it's great to start with a character who is a color where you don't normally get to see
and
that.
In the play, it's not an experience just for black people. I think it's an experience for people to really kind of look at their own American identity and our own, you know, as horrible as 9/11 was, that is one thing that binds us as Americans. Everybody experienced that.
That was one of the things that I wanted to accomplish in the play. I wanted the audience as well as the characters to actually feel the xenophobia and then say, oh, wow. Because like at the top of the play, everybody is these people to everybody else. And, you know, it's sort of like halfway through the play is the first time that Julia even says Nayla's name. because before she just refers to her as these people. And so I wanted the audience to be in that experience and be looking at the stage and making all these preconceptions and judgments and saying, oh, I know exactly what this is all about. That was one goal of the play. Speaking in terms of the director, I think that that was one of the things that drew Shirley Jo Finney to the material at the beginning, that it seemed to be such a different experience.
And I just want to remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking about the play Closely Related Keys, and we're speaking with playwright Wendy Graff and the two main characters in the play, Viara Kilpatrick and Yvonne Huff. And now let me explore this a little bit more, because I really think this point that you guys were hitting on about when you said your character, Diara, is Julia, is really American.
Mm-hmm.
And then Yvonne, when you were saying that you felt your character dealing with these kinds of prejudice, all the other things that are erected, the being told that you're other than of people in the world when they see what America does in the world and does to people. You know, and it's really interesting because that is not something, especially in today's world, I think, where you have anybody who's got any, either a heart and a conscience and ability to think and looks out at what's happening in this country today, in particular in relation to black people, mm-hmm. the Jordan Davis verdict, where a mm-hmm. jury could not convict this admitted racist of murder mm-hmm. when he just leaned over and shot this kid because he didn't like his music, or Trayvon Martin's killer get walks, or stop and frisk.
Arizona.
Yeah. Black people in this society are automatic. They're born suspicious. You know, and according to the way that most of the white people in this society and other people in the structure of society looks at black people, presents that portrait of black people with a target on them because they're suspicious. And then that's the thing that you know, seeing a black family dealing with the same contradiction, but in a different way, was really one of those moments where you are slapped in the head and you're really forced to think like, wait a minute, there's something much bigger that's being wrestled with here.
I just wanted to add to that you're talking about the way that black people are looked at from the perspective of Nayla. You know, it's not really just about that. It's more about the way that she's dressed, the way that she carries herself, you know, even in New York City where there's all different kinds of people there. So I would say that part of the play, using the hijab and all the different kinds of coverings that people who practice Islam wear, it's also about that kind of image too, and what do we see when we see that, and how does that make us feel when we see people dressed that way? So, yeah.
And that's very much related to, if you just wouldn't wear those baggy pants and sag them down, man, everything'd be cool. You'd get a job, you'd have a future, you wouldn't have to worry about all this. I mean, that's the Bill Cosby line, basically. That's a very heavy thing to be putting out in it. And I was stunned by all this, the interplay of all these different contradictions. Really, very, very, very well done, but also very, very disturbing, I think, for a lot of the audience, you know, because you're forced to confront a lot of things objectively that you may not ever think about.
Yeah, and I also think that the play transcends race and goes to the spiritual as well, because at the end of the day, it's like we talked about Julia being so American and so career-driven, and what she's really missing is this sense of wholeness, and it's just happens to be the thing that's going to complete her or heal this wound that she has is someone who just looks like she'd never imagined. And so I think that's kind of the actual heart of the story once you get past all the race.
Yeah, I think
stuff.
That's what I liked about the play too when we first came to it was, how do people pick up the pieces after experiencing 9/11? How do you pick it up and move on? And that what happened to us in the States didn't just happen to us. It happened to people all over the world. And that story never gets told.
Mm-hmm. And that is one of the themes, I think, in the play, is this point about the walls that are erected between people, not always by people themselves, but people take up that kind of view. You know, there's a lot of walls that get erected between people, and they separate us off, and globally as well as, you know, nationally as well as personally. And these walls don't have to separate us. And I think that's one of the things that's really a beautiful part about the play, is that these walls get chipped away at. It's really interesting because there's moments where you can see sort of the wall starting to crack. And one of those moments is the Motown scene, which that's going to stay in my mind as one of the really great scenes in theater. It's just, it was really great, really great. So why don't you tell people a little bit about what that's like, what that was, and then
Early on, Nayla talks about the woman who took care of her, and she says that music is the world's language, and when we all learn to speak it, maybe then there will be peace. So I wanted the two girls to connect through music. So that was kind of the inception of the Motown scene.
Aha. Uh-huh. That was pretty good. And you guys just brought a lot of energy to it, so you both were probably not secret, but probably really out there Motown fans.
Well, I'm from Detroit, so I think you're born a Motown fan growing up in Detroit. And my mother was raised on that music. Like the character that I play, her mother was also raised on that music. And I think when you hear women from that generation talk about seeing the Supremes for the first time on the Sullivan Show, you know, it's that experience I think little black girls felt when Lupita won the Oscar, you know, this weekend. It's like, mm-hmm. They felt seen, they felt alive, they felt valued and validated. And so I think that music held a really special, like, visceral place in their heart. And they did pass that on to their daughters. And so that love, that energy probably did come from that sort of place in the character and then that place in myself.
See, and that's what got expressed, I think. That's what I thought about when I was looking at you guys. All these barriers came down and there was just this sort of this love and this energy that was really intense and really beautiful.
Yeah, I think for Nayla, music is her savior, and she's trying to find a way to connect, and the thing that she knows that has brought her peace, other than her faith, is music. So yeah, I think when we were playing it, we were just having fun and letting it go. I mean, we're so and then we can just, even as actors, just kind of let it rip.
And the kind of secret ingredient, too, I think, to the chemistry is that Yvonne and I played sisters before, and I forgot.
That's right.
I think we were in the middle of rehearsing that moment when I said, we've done this before.
We have played.
Pulled me around on a stage before.
I pulled her around on a stage, It was an adaptation of Three Sisters set in Trinidad in 1941.
Yeah, Three Sisters after Chekhov.
So different circumstances, but still that soul, I guess, that energy was still there. Yeah.
Wendy, you said that one of the things you learned very intensely off of this play was about Iraq and what happened. And I was thinking about this in relation to what we're talking about, because it's not just when you talk about 9/11. It's not, yes, it was a terrible thing that happened. None of those people that were in that building deserved to get the death that they got. Terrorism in any form is, I think, despicable. And at the same time, you have an entire country that was subjected to the most intense kind of terrorism you can get, where the most powerful force in the history of the world is unleashing, I mean, total devastation. I was just reading something, I can't remember. Well, I think you were talking about it. The things that used to exist in Iraq, and then thinking about what exists now. And then when you're confronted with a black person who has gone through this, as your character Julia is, who actually has all this stuff of your almost Republican or are Republican or whatever.
Or don't mind representing Republicans.
And you're defending some of the most heinous criminals on the face of the planet, you know, and you're fighting for their interests. And yet on some of these other things, you have your love relationship has to be kept secret because of not wanting to stir things up professionally. And then your character who also has to, Yvonne, your character also has to hide certain things and do all these things. Mm-hmm. And it just really struck me that the devastation that has been unleashed on the world, not by 9/11, but what that unleashed in the U.S. to go out and take over the world is really a huge piece of this in terms of the bigger picture. So, Wendy, let's talk about that a little
bit. Well, you know, when I wrote the play, I'm not one of these writers who, like, writes a play, has a roadmap, knows exactly where I'm going to go, story. So it reveals itself to me. I sort of wander down the road and, you know, then I find all these things and they seem to resonate in different areas. And the whole Iraq thing seemed to be such a metaphor and seemed to resonate. And I'm ashamed to say, you know, before this, I didn't know that much about Iraq. I mean, Iraq was like a headline to me or a story on the news. I didn't know the humanity, the people behind the story. And I spent a lot of time looking at YouTubes of women and in Iraq and discovered that women were better off under Saddam. They were so much better off under Saddam. They were allowed to work. They were allowed to dress as they pleased. They weren't locked up and veiled and put behind walls. So the more I dove into this, I became like obsessed watching all this stuff and reading about it. And Anthony Shadid's book was the one that just like It just killed me. It just slayed me because he was in Iraq all like from 2000 to 2010. And he just wrote so extensively about the ordinary people and the effect on their lives and everything. So that's kind of where I got interested in the whole Iraq thing. And it just so beautifully fell into place of that I could say something even more now on a global level. It could be a metaphor for something even on a global level, the family of man. You know, we have this family, and the family could be anybody. It doesn't have to be black or white or green or blue or whatever. But it's a family, and then we have the whole family of man.
I think that's what I was thinking about when I was talking about all this other stuff before, is it compels you to step back, and then everything you're seeing about how each character is treated raises questions, and that overall situation raises questions about all the various individual and group expressions of that, you know, what happens to different people and different groups of people in this society. And it does force you to question this in a big way, in a really good way. I was going to ask you one more question because we're running out of time. What was it that you were most deeply impacted by and that you can see as like something that shifted a change in you?
I think through the process of the play, and I would have to say through the writing of it and the reading it in writing groups and doing the workshops and doing the rehearsal and everything, I think through the process, it forced me also to let go of preconceived stereotypes. I think, you know, before I wrote this play, I think I had a lot more preconceived stereotypes than I would care to admit right now. You know, both religiously and racially and humanity and so on. And I think that really getting inside the skin of these characters who some on the surface are so different from me made me see how we're not so different. And when I approached these characters, like when I approached the Guyanese lesbian, you know, everybody said, how can you write a story about a Guyanese lesbian? And Kathleen Foley at the LA Times said if she didn't know any better, she would have thought it was autobiographical. And I think it's because I try to dig deep inside myself and find the similarities rather than the differences and work from the inside out rather than the outside in.
Yeah, I think that's something that really comes across in this play.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've been talking with playwright Wendy Graff and two of the actors from her new play, Closely Related Keys, Diarra Kilpatrick and Yvonne Huff. I want to thank all you guys for coming in today.
Thank you, Michael.
Once again, you've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And don't forget, tune in next week for part two of my interview with filmmaker Hubert Saupere about his new film, We Come as Friends. We're going to go out now with a little bit more from Congo Part 1 from The Twisting Kings.